away with. Most of the value in these kits is really going to be what you do with them afterwards, so you can take them away and try some of these things for yourself. Also, a couple of people have asked me if it's possible to still buy the kits afterwards, and I hadn't actually anticipated that, but that's a good idea. So right at the end of this, I'll remind people, if anybody wants to put in an order, I will take some names and I'll see what I can arrange. Basically, these kits, I just bought parts from various places and chucked them all in the box, but I'm happy to do the same thing for other people that want it. So, welcome. Thanks for coming. What I'm here to do this morning is to free your mind. So, you can think of me as being a little bit like Morpheus, but without the style. And I suppose that makes you Neo. What Morpheus did was teach Neo how to see the world in this way, but I'm going to do something a little bit different. I'm going to teach you instead to see the world as if it's made of Lego. By the end of this, you're going to see everything in terms of little pieces that you can rearrange and manipulate to suit yourself and refashion reality. You won't be able to stop bullets by the end of this tutorial, but you will feel like a kid in a toy shop looking around at all the things that you can do. So what I'm going to do is show you how to reimagine reality, physical reality that's around you, devices that you come across in everyday life, and try to bend them to your purposes and make them do different things, link them together in ways that the makers never intended. So yeah, there is a warning. Danger of death. This is not a typical warning at a software conference. And some of the things that I'm going to talk to you about involve modifying mains powered equipment and things like that. There are some safety precautions you can take, which I will show you along the way. But as the lawyers say, I accept my responsibility, etc. So we're used to working in the world of software. We work inside the computer, inside the box, and we really need to get out of it if we're going to do some really interesting things with linking into the real world. So the question is, how do you link in? And there are a whole bunch of different ports on the back of your box. As a matter of interest, how many people have seen me do a talk about hardware hacking previously, like last year? Maybe a bunch of you. Okay. So what you would have seen last year was mainly focusing on the parallel port. The parallel port is a good port to start with if you're just wanting to begin hooking things into a computer. All you've got is a laptop or a desktop or a machine or whatever, and you don't have much background in electronics, because it's a really dumb port. It's very simple. It's got no flow control, no comms protocol. Basically, a parallel port on the back of a computer, if you look at it, is simply a representation of chunks of memory from the computer. And the typical parallel port takes up 3 bytes of address space. You can see the D lines across the top there. And there are 8 of them, D0 to D7. That is 1 byte of memory inside the computer. And we all know how to manipulate memory. I mean, we play around with software, so that stuff's pretty easy. So the parallel port is just a physical representation out of the back of your computer of memory space. That's how simple it is. So it makes it very easy to manipulate it. But the parallel port is also bad because it's dumb. There's very little scripting language support for it. There's not a whole lot you can do directly from within languages like Perl and Python and whatever else you might want to use. And a lot of the point of what I'm showing you today is using tiny little chunks of code, not big monolithic projects to, you know, build some automation system. What I'm showing you is tiny little snippets that might only be a few lines long, and use them to glue stuff together. And typically that sort of thing is done in scripting languages, but parallel port support for scripting languages is very poor. So you can do it with a trivial C helper. And this is mainly what I focused on in the talk last year. And it's actually only a couple of lines of code. There's not all that much to it. In fact, I'll go and find it. Find it from a previous talk, so I'm not actually going to use that in this talk. LPTR, maybe this one will do. Don't know if you can read that, but this is how simple it is to push a value out the parallel port in C. Basically, you just have to include a couple of libraries And you'll see up there, there's a definition for the port address at hex 378, which is the default value for the first parallel port on a typical x86 or whatever it is architecture. And all we're doing is taking a value that's passed in as an argument to this little program and then pushing it blindly out the parallel port. So what you can do is if you pass it a value of 1, you'll get the first bit being turned on, give it a value of 2, second bit, value of 3, you get the first and second bits, and so on. So you can very easily flip bits on the parallel port using a little program like this. And conversely, you can read bits in as well. So obviously out there's a corresponding little program, which is even less lines of code. And whenever you call this, all it does is read a byte of data off the parallel port and display it to you. So if you have buttons, for example, or some kind of digital input that you want to read, or a switch, and this is another point, is that just about everything in the physical world that you can control represents itself as a switch. If you look at random things like a motion detector, it's just a switch. The actual connection to it is simply a pair of pins that are shorted out whenever the device is triggered. And that's the case for an awful lot of things that you might want to talk to. So in a lot of the time, you can simply treat something as a switch and read inputs from it. So you could use a simple script like this to poll an input and then do whatever you want to do. And this is all very fine and well if you're dealing with just the parallel port. But the parallel port is very limited because typically you only have one of them. It's only got a limited amount of I/O on it. It's only digital. You don't get any analog input and things like that. So what we're going to have a look at today is the Arduino board. Now, these things are really cool. So it's a little board, fits in the palm of your hand like that. And it's basically as open source as you can get, because not only is the software stack that runs on top of this board open source, the actual hardware designs are licensed under Creative Commons. So you can download the schematics, you can assemble these boards, you can manufacture and sell them yourselves if you want to, which is really cool. And there is a very active ecosystem now built up around this this design. And there are a number of variants because people have modified it to come up with different variations depending on their particular requirements. The board that I've included in the kits for the people who have got them is the most common one. It's got a USB interface on it. It's got, I think, 13 I/O lines. It's got some analog inputs. You can do pulse width modulated output. And it's a really good general purpose development board. It's got headers on the top so you can just plug jumpers into it. And you can either read inputs or drive outputs from it. And all you need is a USB interface to talk to it. And they're reasonably cheap. And these particular ones I bought from a place up in Sydney called Little Bird Electronics. And the boards themselves, like this particular model of board, is about $40 just for that board. And there is, as you can see on the screen there, there's a smaller version that's on a US 10-cent piece, I think it is. A quarter, okay. So they're quite small. And the one up in the top right is a slightly older model, but that's got a Bluetooth interface on it. So in that particular one, the Bluetooth device enumerates itself as a serial port on the computer that you pair with it. And so you can program this without even being plugged into it. The IDE will recognize the virtual serial port, talk to it over Bluetooth, and you can be pushing software and doing updates on this without even being connected. They run off extremely low power as well. By default, they will leech power off the USB, so they just take a 5-volt input. They've also got a power socket on it, so you can plug in a 9-volt battery or something like that, and they will run for ages because they take very little power. So you can program them up, dump a little program onto them, unplug them from your computer and just keep them running. Stick them on a solar cell on a battery or something like that, and they'll run forever. Very cool. And also there's a new model. If you're wanting to do to save a little bit of money, there is a new model that I actually hadn't heard of until last week called the Bare Bones Kit. And it's a slightly more primitive looking unit. It doesn't have the multi-layer circuit board and things like that, but it's got it doesn't have the USB interface on it. What they've done is taken the USB interface off and cut it down to just the bare system itself so that there's minimal cost on the board. and they have an adapter cable. So you plug a USB in at one end and it's got the actual FTDI driver chip in the cable, so you just plug it into a header. Those boards complete, I think, are $17.50. Now, plus GST, so it's like $20 for a complete microcontroller that you can play around with in a totally open source environment. So really, really cool stuff. So for those of you who have laptops and want to play around with this sort of stuff, there are a couple of things you can do. That's right. One thing you'll need to do is grab the installer. Now, hopefully this is going to work. We shall see what happens. I've actually stuck this on my laptop. So if you go to that IP address, 169.229, let's give it a test. Yeah, my laptop's about to be DOS'd. There are some archives there. So if you're wanting to actually play around with this stuff, we can do some experiments right now, and you can power up the board that you've got and make it flash an LED, which is the hardware equivalent of Hello World, and do some things like that. Yes? Sorry? Oh, yeah. The actual authoritative location for this, if you want to, if you're online and you want to go and check it all out, and there's lots of documentation, is arduino.cc. Creative Commons, hey. Great reuse of the Cocos Islands top-level domain. So this is the homepage of the Arduino board itself. So if anybody wants to go poking around on there, that's the place to start. And there is heaps of information on there. There are lots of tutorials about doing things. There is also the download location here for the software. The thing is, though, that for the Mac and Windows versions, because I think they bundle the Java environment or something with it, it's pretty big. So that's the reason I've stuck it on my laptop, so we don't all sit here trying to download 55 meg of stuff. Yes. Okay, if you're doing it on a Linux-based distro, there are a couple of things you need to install. One thing that trapped me the first time I tried this, it took me ages to figure this out. Whenever I was plugging the device in, it was recognizing the Arduino device as a Braille terminal. I was like, what the hell? It's because the device identifier in the USB chip is actually recognized by the Linux kernel, or by the driver, the Braille TTY driver, as a Braille terminal. So unfortunately, you have to actually uninstall the BRL TTY driver in order to have it recognize this device. So I'm not sure if that's a... I'm not sure what sort of a problem that is for people that actually use Braille devices. Probably not good. And there are a couple of other packages that you need to install as well. You also need to make sure that you're using the Sun release of Java. So, sorry, I'm not familiar enough. I don't know. You can be our beta test case, yeah. So, who's having a go at this right now? Yeah, okay, there are a few people. Cool. Well, for the benefit of everybody else, I'll show you what is happening if I can find myself and pull out the little kit. I'll put this back on the screen in a moment for those that need it. Does anybody else still need that address, or should all have it by now, those that need it? Okay, cool. So once you've extracted it, Arduino Linux. What you'll end up with is a directory with a few odds and ends in it. And the actual Arduino IDE itself, and because I've already installed those other packages, hopefully this will work. Or maybe it won't. Oh, it did. Okay, cool. Unfortunately, I don't know if there's any way to zoom the editor interface. Yeah. I had problems with the external display with CompUs, so I disabled it during this tutorial. Yeah. Okay, so once you start it up, you end up with this this IDE, which is actually based on, I should tell you a little bit of the history of this. It's based on a system called Processing. And essentially what happened with the development of the Arduino was that they wanted a physical representation of the software environment that came out of the processing project. And there was a there was another associated project called Wiring. And so if you've used either of those before, it's the same IDE. They changed the colors and that's it. And they've made a few other minor tweaks in terms of talking to the actual hardware itself. But if you're familiar with that IDE, then it'll be the same thing. So has anybody managed to get to the point where they've got an IDE up and running? Cool. Okay. Who wants another minute or two? Yep. Okay. Yeah, sure. Okay. Yeah, give it a try. Yes. I don't think it is, no. It's it should be available on the Arduino.cc site. I think their Subversion repository is available online as well, so you can go crazy with it. Oh. Okay, so you're running 64-bit environment. Oops, sorry. Okay, anybody need this still? Cool, everybody sorted with that one? All right, so in this environment, there are a couple of things you need to select. This is deliberately not going to work, because I want to show you what happens. With the serial port, you need to specify to the IDE where it's going to find the device to talk to. By default, I've only got one serial port on this machine, and that's the modem. And I don't have the device plugged in, so I've got no USB interface at the moment. So what you need to do is make sure you plug in the board. I suspect I'll have to restart, we shall see. Oh no, it detected it. Fantastic. So it's detected dev USB 0. So we've now got a device that we can talk to. Oh yeah, you shouldn't be seeing that yet. Yeah, but it powers up basically to show that the board is running. Now, how many people here have actually used an Arduino board before? Has anybody played with one? Yeah, a couple. Okay. Did you play, which model? Was it the NG or the dissimilar or something like that? Okay. Okay, because the dissimilar is a brand new model. Up until this one, which just came out, you had to manually reset them in order to do the upload of the program from the computer. You don't have to do that? Okay. There are still a lot of those ones around. So if you buy an Arduino board, it's quite likely that you'll have to, when you want to do an upload out of the IDE onto the machine, what happens is that there's a little bootloader on the board itself. When it starts up, it starts looking at the serial port to see if there is a new image available for it to execute. It's like a pixie boot thing, I suppose, on a tiny scale. And it does that, I think, for 6 seconds after startup or after reset. So what you have to do is press the reset button, and then within 6 seconds, tell the IDE to start pushing it across. On the versions that you've got, for the people that got kits, this is the brand new model. You don't have to do that. It's all taken care of in software. So the bootloader is smart enough to figure it out. When you start pushing the system over, it can be running a program, and it doesn't matter if you start pushing a new image to it, it'll go, hey, new image, suck it down and start executing it. So that's pretty cool. So if you have this up, the IDE comes with a bunch of example code. If you go into, where am I? I've got to find it. New sketchbook. It stores the little program. The programs are called sketches. I'm not sure why, but there's some reason for it. And so what it does is store all of the little program snippets in the sketchbook. You go to sketchbook examples, and there are a whole bunch here, which are really good for playing around with these boards for the first time and learning how they work, because they exercise a few different features of it, like the digital input, digital output, analog output, talking to different kinds of devices. So if you have something that you can plug into it, there's probably a little example program here which you can use as a starter on your own software. So that's an example. Let's go and have a look at the electronic equivalent of Hello World. Now, the way the Arduino hardware works, it's got multi-purpose I.O. pins. So what do you need to do when you first... Is it legible? Have people at the back, can you kind of follow that? Yep, okay. Problem is, if I do that, all the lights go off. We'll give it a try, and we'll see what happens. Nope, what about that? Oh, okay, perfect. So you've still got enough illumination out there as well. Great. Yeah, all the glow of the laptop screens. Is that okay from a camera point of view? You'll have to live with it. Sorry. Okay, so what we're doing here, it's very simple. Basically what we're doing is defining... Yep. 169-222-9169. Okay. So what we're doing here, if you've worked with any kind of scripting environment, I assume everybody here has done some form of programming. Yeah. Okay. So what we're doing basically is defining an integer LED pin, pin 13. On the standard Arduino boards, there are, I think, 13 I.O. lines, digital I.O. lines. And by default, the 13th I.O. line is treated as a bit of a special case, because one of the standard things that you want to do, if you put a little program on this, you can't tell if it's running, basically. There's no screen, nothing to tell you. So the 13th line, although it's available for you to use, is typically used simply for a status LED. And on the older boards, it had a dropper resistor in series with it already, so all you had to do was get an LED, stick it in, and it would work. These newer boards actually have the LED surface mounted directly onto the PCB, so you don't have to do a thing, it's just there. So if you address pin 13, you can make the LED flash on and off, and you can use that as a status indicator to show you that something is happening on your board. It uses visual feedback. So what we're doing in this little program is defining that LED pin is pin 13, and then we're setting the pin mode to output, because each of the pins can be either an input or an output. So we're saying treat pin 13 as an output. And then we're running a little loop with a delay. Should be very obvious what this is. So 1 second on, 1 second off, and there it goes. So the way you actually use this IDE, I don't know why they termed it this, but they have a little thing here that says verify. It's actually compile. It calls GCC in the back end and converts the program that you have here into the appropriate format to send across to the board. So hit compile, and down the bottom, couldn't determine program size. It does that sometimes if it, just try it again. It does that sometimes if it couldn't identify the type of board, so I just did it again and it figured it out. There are a couple of different variations of the board. Some of them have got different CPUs on them, which have got different memory amount available to them and things like that. And so when it does the compile, it has to know what type of target it's compiling for. Okay, so what we need to do now is push it across to the board. So we started with compiling it. We now have our little blob, our little binary sketch of 1.1K in size, ready to push across. So just press upload to I/O board. And you probably won't be able to see it, but on this, the little RX and TX LEDs are blinking furiously as it's pushing the image across. And it's probably very hard to see, but there is now an LED that's blinking on and off at 1 hertz. Does anybody else? Oh, thank you. My crowning achievement. I just need the sunglasses. Okay, well, people have got the boards. Has anybody managed to get this working? Yep. Cool. Anybody wanting a bit more time, wanting to play with that? Sorry? I'm still downloading Java, yeah. Actually, what's the speed like? Is the connection reasonable here? Okay. Cool. Sorry? View the links? Maybe in a little bit. I won't do it right now. Sorry. Okay. And there are some other random things we can do as well. But you'll find if you go through, where was it? Sketchbook examples. There are a whole bunch of examples in here. So fading an LED in and out and all of that sort of thing. So back to here. Where were we up to? All right. Now we'll really test the bandwidth. How many people here have played around inside Second Life? Okay. So there are a lot of people that actually haven't. Where is it? It may not. This is one of the dangers of doing all this sort of stuff live. Plug into the wired Ethernet. If I do that, my IP is going to change, I assume. So downloads will stop. I better not do that. This will be an interesting experiment. We might let it play with itself for a while. Sorry, what's the what? I will show you that in a second. That's what we're trying to get to. Because one of the interesting things about Second Life is that it's specifically designed to be a development platform. It's not a situation where they've said, here is the content, go and use it. It's here is a platform, go and build stuff on top of it. And if you think about it, well, in terms of the technology, Second Life is very much like a 3D computer game. And in a computer game, lots of stuff is scriptable. You walk up to a door and you can open it and objects interact with you and things like that. A game environment has a lot of scripting in it. But the thing is that most of it is hidden below the surface. And as a gamer, you can't typically go in and simply change stuff inside an environment. The way Second Life has been set up, the development environment is the viewer. If you are inside the environment, using Second Life itself, you've got all the tools you need right there to actually do coding directly in world. So if we can get the machine up and running, I'll show you. I am? Oh, you can see me. Cool. Thank you. Now, the most important thing about the concept of Linden scripting language is that it's all based around the concept of a state machine. So I assume most of you know what a state machine is. Yep. Cool. The thing is that a state machine is a fantastic way of representing behavior of physical objects, which is essentially what Second Life is trying to do. Because objects have states. They might be at rest or moving or on or off or whatever. And as objects interact with each other, they might change state and have different reactions. You have, you touch a light switch and a light turns on. So you have a trigger which causes a change of state. And pretty much everything inside Second Life is based on the state machine concept. So, yeah, states and triggers or events. And you can define a whole bunch of states. Basically, you can define whatever states you like within your code. You can't actually define the triggers. There are a lot of predefined triggers within LSL itself. And the trigger might be something like an avatar touched an object. What you can then do is define your own handlers for those triggers or for those events. So you can say, if I have a an object touched event, then I want to go into this state or execute this particular thing. So it makes you can make objects reactive in a really, really simple way. And if you're working with a state machine in most coding environments, just about any language, and you want a state machine, you have to write the state machine in order to put this, the actual program structure in place around it. In Lyndon scripting language, the environment is a state machine. You can't get out of it. Even if there's only one state, the default state is still inside a state machine. So you don't have to care about any of that infrastructure. It's all done for you. All of the links between handling triggers from external events, it's all taken care of. So that makes it really easy. So let's have a quick look, if I am indeed online. Ah, I am. Cool. So here I am wandering around inside my virtual environment, which is being fairly slow still. And I can do things that I couldn't typically do inside the real world, like fly and be a unicorn and things like that, which I've chosen not to do, obviously. And now it won't let me go down. Yes, going down. Down, down, I say. Yeah, I need to go to the virtual solarium. Actually, talking about virtual cancer reminds me. There have been some... I don't know why that reminded me. There have been some... There have been some really interesting little exercises inside Second Life, which is not necessarily directly related to this talk. Hey, Caleb, who's that? Hands up! Okay, except... We're friends now. there have been some... At least it was an unhealthy frog. Oh, come on, it's so laggy. There have been some really interesting experiments inside Second Life. One of the things about working with objects and state machines is that it makes it really easy to do simulations of complex environments and interactions between lots of things. And I don't know why virtual cancer reminded me of this, but there is a an island inside Second Life where they have created an entire ecosystem consisting of animals that predate on other animals. And they end up with stable populations and things like that. And there is a there are people that have done things like written a really tiny little algorithm to run a virtual fish. So they have schools of fish, and they emulate the schooling behavior and evading predators and things like that with only a couple of lines of code. So the concept of a state machine in terms of representing physical objects and interaction between objects is really, really powerful. This is so laggy, it's ridiculous. Actually, part of the problem... That should make things better. Updating the terminal in the back of the window freaks it out for some reason. do you want to do that? Or can you grab it off someone else that's already got it? Has someone downloaded? Cool, thank you. Okay. Now, when the Second Life platform was put together, as I said, it was all about creating a platform and tools to allow people to create things. They thought very hard about the issues of intellectual property and things like that. And they built in a permission system, which can actually be subverted, but basically what they've done is they've tried to create an environment where you can determine how much control you have over objects that you create. So you can create something and then give it certain permissions. For example, nobody is allowed to copy this object. Or you can say, everybody is allowed to copy this object. Or people are allowed to copy this object, but it costs them 10 virtual dollars every time they do. You know, that sort of thing. Or you can copy it once, but then you can't pass it on to anybody else. So it's like a Microsoft license, not transferable. So right here, all I have to do is right-click somewhere in here, go create. I've got a little circular menu, and I've got a wand. And the other thing is that if you're wanting to create something, because they don't want total chaos and people creating anything anywhere, you can only create objects in certain environments where you have permissions. there are a whole bunch of public sandboxes around. So if you want to start playing around with this sort of stuff, you just do a search for public sandbox, and you'll find somewhere that you can go, and you'll find lots of people creating random things. If you've paid to own land, then you have build permissions on that, and you have a limit in terms of the number of polygons, essentially, that that you can create. They're called prims. So a prim is just a primitive. It's a shape or an object, and it counts as one object. So, for example, a box or a cube is one prim. And if you have multiples, you can stick them together, and there's a limit on how many you can have. So all I did was right-click, select Create, click somewhere in the world that I have create privileges, and I've got myself a little cube, which is the default object inside Second Life. And it's got a bunch of parameters. It's got a name, description, and things like that, owner and creator, and I can do things like say whether this can be shared with people in a group and all of those sorts of things. The interesting thing from our point of view is if we go into content, basically everything is scriptable. So if we click new script, half an hour later, oh, hi, Ecross. Half an hour later, we will get a new script. Okay. And if we double click it, we actually get the script contents itself. So what I'm doing here is using the exact same environment that every single user in Second Life has. If you log into Second Life, you have this environment. You can create an object, add it, attach a script to it, and start making it do cool things. So when you create a script, this is the default script that it inserts into it. And basically it's got, an entry state, like when an object is what's called resed or brought into resolution or created, it goes into the entry state. That's just the first thing it does. So in this particular case, the first thing it's going to do is say, LL say channel zero, which is just talk to the world, hello avatar. So it's going to say hello when we create it. And it also has an event handler for a touch start event. And whenever it's touched, all it's going to do is say, I've been touched. You touched me. So we'll hit reset just so we can see the little message. We'll close all of this. And you can see down the bottom that because the object was reset, it's just said, hello, avatar. So let's just follow that. So if I now click on that, it'll say touched. And if our friend, one of our friends over here touches it, if someone else touch it, and it should do the same thing. All right. Stop getting undressed. Okay, taking time for the textures to download. Okay, so we don't want to see your source code. So, yay. Okay, so that is how easy it is to create an object inside Second Life. So what I'm doing here is I'm showing you very, very little building blocks, and then we're going to start joining these building blocks together and try to do some more interesting things. So we can now flash an LED. So we can do the electronic hello world in there. We can create an object in here which reacts when it's touched and says something. So that's the equivalent of hello world inside in the scripting language. So there are a few things you can do. This is where it starts to get interesting in terms of linking Second Life out into other things. HTTP out of Second Life. You can basically call any URL out of a script. That means that you can trigger remote events. So if you have some device out in the real world which happens to have a web API, it means that you can directly control it from inside Second Life by calling URIs. And that's remarkably easy. We'll do a bit of a demo of that in a little bit once we start joining a whole bunch of things together. You can also do XML RPC into Second Life. Now, that sounded expensive. Now, when we created that object, it was given an ID. Every single object inside Second Life has some kind of an ID, which makes it addressable. And the address includes things like the actual location of the object in terms of the region. Now, the way Second Life works at a technical level is that there is what's called the grid. This is a whole bunch of servers, and there are a lot of them, that each run a little section of reality. So you have the world as a whole, which is divided up into areas or into regions, and then subdivide it into little sections. And essentially there is a server environment or a machine which is running that particular environment, or that particular part of the environment. And they understand their position within the overall grid. So as you walk around, you can start at one end, one corner of the Second Life universe, and you could just walk all the way to the other end if you wanted to. And the state and the attributes of the objects that move across the grid are passed from server to server. So it's actually a pretty impressive technological feat, considering how many machines and how many users and things there are involved in this. And I know that the membership figures in Second Life are overinflated, and there's some huge number. I don't know what the latest figure they talk about is. It's like 3 million or something. But even if you look at the actual figures, like the number of logged in users, at any one particular point in time, there might be 20 or 30,000 people logged into Second Life right now. And they are tracking in real time the position of all of those avatars, all of those people, and the interactions between them, and the objects that they come across. So I saw some figures on this recently. I should have noted it down. But the actual object database that runs behind the scenes at Second Life is in the order of multiple terabytes of data. Does anybody have figures on that? I saw someone nodding their head there. Yeah, it's multiple terabytes. So it's a big MySQL database. Lots of MySQL databases. So and the point of all of that is that what they have done is created an XML RPC gateway, which is publicly exposed. And you can make XML RPC calls in through this gateway and address any object inside Second Life by its unique identifier. And it will then, if you have a handler inside the object to accept an XML RPC message, you know, request, you can have a handler that does something with that. So that opens up a number of possibilities. We have bidirectional communication. We can do web requests out. We can do XML RPC requests in. So we can have objects inside the Second Life environment that respond in near real time. I mean, there's a bit of delay, obviously. Paul, you're being paged from the back of the room, I think. In near real time. So if you're wanting to simply trigger one-off events that don't happen regularly, then XML RPC is a really cool way to do it. So we might have a look at that in a little bit as well. Email out of Second Life you can also do. So you can simply create an email inside your script and then say send to blah, and the person will receive an email saying it came from this particular object at Second Life. And conversely, you can do email into Second Life. So you can send email to an object and then have it parse the message body and then respond appropriately. So these are, what I've been talking to you about so far, these particular communications methods are reasonably low bandwidth, high latency. In terms of the concept, that, in terms of the scales that we think about from the software development point of view, when you can send an email, it might take a couple of seconds to get there, or do an XML RPC request, and if you're lucky, it'll go through in, you know, a few hundred milliseconds sort of thing. So it's quick, it's pretty cool, but it's not real time, and it's not guaranteed delivery. You can't do, you can't push a lot of data through. So there are some other ways that you can do that. One of the ways that you can do it is with a modified Second Life client. This was when Linden Labs open sourced the Second Life client. This was one of the first mods that was done. There's a friend of mine, there's a UK developer named Matt Bedolf, who took the source code and modified it so that, in fact, I might show you this movie a little bit later on. I'll pull it up during the break so you can see it later. What he did was modified a Second Life client so that he patched it through to read data coming off an Arduino board. And he had an analog input into the Arduino board so that as you adjust the input, the client would be notified and it would say, that input has just changed its value. And it would then, because the client itself is logged into the Second Life environment, it can do a lot in terms of message transactions and message passing very fast with relatively low latency. I mean, obviously I'm lagged all the hell here because of the bandwidth issues. But in a normal situation, if you're logged in as using a Second Life client, the client itself is pumping a lot of data backwards and forwards about positional data and noises that people are making in the environment around you and things like that. So what he did was set it up so that the client would talk to an object and one of the things I haven't shown you is that you can do chat in Second Life, and you can either just talk to everything in your environment and it will hear you, or you can do what's called whispering, which is basically talking to a specific object, so only that particular object. Or you can IM things and whisper, which is, you know, short range and all that sort of stuff. So what we did was set it up so that the client would talk to the object, and the object had an event handler that was listening for messages, and he had an attribute of this particular object, which was the altitude of the object. So essentially what he did was put an altitude knob in hardware that he could twist, and inside Second Life this object would move up and down, which was quite cool. And he did that, I think it was, you know, 2 or 3 days after the Second Life client was released as open source. This was the sort of stuff that people started hacking on really early on when it first came out. That in itself is pretty cool, and there have been lots of other things done in relation to that as well. But if you really want to pump lots and lots of data through or have very low latency, you don't necessarily want to be running a full GUI client just to be passing some messages in and out. You may have a situation where you're acquiring data from the real world, and you want to get lots of data in very rapidly and have it represented inside the Second Life environment. And it might be some automatic monitoring system. You don't have someone sitting there looking at a screen, so you don't care about the GUI. You couldn't give a stuff. So there was a project that started actually before the Second Life client was open source called LibSecondLife. This was a reverse engineering effort. So they sat down and sniffed the packets and figured out what was going on, and they did basically a clean room implementation of the Second Life communications protocol, and they were very smart about it. They wrote it as a library so that it could be reused in ways that they hadn't originally thought of. And that project has actually been very successful. There have been a whole lot of things done with this. And if you want to write a little program which just runs off the command line and logs into Second Life and, you know, does stuff on your behalf, you can use LibSecondLife to do that. And I'm pretty sure it's GPL. I'm sure it's open source. I can't remember what license. I think it's GPL. BSD. Excellent. So, yeah, that's really cool. Actually, one of the interesting stories that came out of that was that a little while ago there was a developer who wrote a web-based interface to Second Life using LibSecondLife. So you pull up a web browser and it would show you a map of where you were logged into, and you could chat to other users and things like that. And it was kind of stunning example of what could be done that people just wouldn't think of. You think, what's the point of that? The thing is that a lot of people using Second Life as a forum for social interaction, they don't necessarily have a heavyweight 3D GUI client available to them all the time. And the actual backstory to this was that when this was released, a lot of people, it was released on what's called the teen grid. So it's a grid that's restricted to teenage access only, because there's a lot of stuff that happens on the main grid that we don't want to tell teenagers about yet. It was only available on the teen grid, and people were saying, where did this come from? Like, we want to play with it on the main grid. And the developer said, oh, sorry, I haven't actually made it work on the main grid yet because I'm not old enough to even test it. Turned out that I think it was a 15-year-old schoolgirl in the UK that had written this. And so, yeah, it's quite amazing what people will do once you give them a couple of building blocks like this. And so what she did was she wanted to be able to get into Second Life and do IM and things like that, interact with other people just from a quick little web interface without having to do the whole heavyweight GUI. So lots of cool stuff you can do with LibSecondLife. Now this is where things start getting really heavy if you want to pump lots and lots of data through. And it's probably one of the most problematic areas. When Linden Lab opened up they've stated for a long time that their intention has been to go open source stack, you know, top to bottom on Second Life, but the reality of releasing that has been a little bit problematic for them. And it's quite understandable if you think about it. What they've done is they've created an environment that has a virtual economy. There are people interact, and there are people who actually run businesses inside Second Life now, and they make real dollars out of this. It's a controlled environment. If you start allowing people to run their own SIMs, then where is the metadata stored? For example, if you flip across to here, you can see I've got a bank balance of just under 11,000 Linden dollars, which are the virtual dollars. So where is the metadata stored for what's in my bank account? If you start letting people run their own sims and create their own objects and things like that, what's to stop them simply saying, I have infinity dollars, and things like that? So there is a there are some very serious issues that they have to deal with in terms of opening up the grid. There is a project called the Open Grid Project, I think it is, which is a bunch of people who are related to the Live Second Life project, whose objective basically is to build the server side of it as well, so that you can do this totally in an open source way, but more than that, in a way that's totally under your control. So you can have control from the client side all the way through to the actual server that people are interacting on. Now, this is really interesting from the point of view of large companies that want to get into this, or people that want to do very outrageous stuff, like real-time simulations of things. In fact, one of the interesting applications of this that I heard, I was over in the US a little while ago doing a tutorial on this sort of stuff. One of the guys in the tutorial I was talking to afterwards, and he was saying, he was telling me that he's a mining engineer, a mine safety engineer. And what he wanted to do was build a 3D representation of his mine in Second Life, feed telemetry data off the trucks and the loaders and things, and have a real-time representation of what's going on. So they could go inside Second Life, walk through the mine, and see in real time where everybody was, what they were doing, and things like that. So there are some really cool things that, I would never have thought of that. But there are some really cool things that you can do once you start having control over the entire environment from the server down to the client. And that sort of thing just is very hard to do unless you have that level of control. And there are some other interesting projects. How many people here have heard about the tennis thing that IBM done? Okay, a couple. Yeah, someone out here that might have heard of it. There was a simulation, some work done by IBM to take data from a number of sources associated with Wimbledon. So when a tennis match is played, there's a whole bunch of electronics on the ground, and IBM actually supply a bunch of that. So if you watch the tennis, you'd probably be familiar with the Hawkeye system that, you know, checks whether a ball is in or out and all of that sort of thing. And there are a number of systems like that that use a whole bunch of different technologies like cameras and stuff to acquire data in real time from center court. So what they did was built a representation of Wimbledon inside Second Life, pulled data off these data sources, and then they represent it in virtual reality. So you could be standing in center court Wimbledon and watching the actual motion of the ball as it's been pulled out of the data source, like out of the Hawkeye system and various associated things, which is a really, really interesting thing. So part of the point of all of this, what I'm wanting to get across today is that all of us come at this from a different perspective. We've all got imaginations. We will all think of things that nobody else has thought of. And so what I really want to get you thinking about is not just replicating what other people have done, but think of some crazy application. What is it that you think would be cool to build? And then let's see how we can go about building it. So if we can put together in place the tools and the building blocks and things like that, and then let our imaginations go crazy, then we can do some really cool stuff. So, okay. What I'll do is I'll go through a couple more steps of this, you know, sort of lecture style, and then we'll get into more of the hands-on stuff, and we'll try modifying some things, and I'll see if I can burn myself on a soldering iron and stuff like that. How many people here have had some contact with electronics? Hey! Well, in that case, I can just go. You got that, right? Cool. Okay. So, that, believe it or not, is actually an 8088, I think it is, based microcomputer running, yeah, implemented on a breadboard, which is kind of cool. Considering that breadboards have frequency issues and things like that. That's about as far as you can push it. Resistor, transistor, multimeter, lots of things. Being slow, skipping through. Okay. So we'll skip through that sort of stuff. a lot of the time when I'm talking about this sort of stuff, I'm talking to people who have got a purely software background. They've got no idea about any of that sort of thing. So hardware building blocks. One of the really useful little things is to take one of the digital level signals out of this and be able to control something out in the real world using a relay to isolate yourself from the fact that you're dealing with low voltage here and who knows what voltage out there. So one of the little building blocks that's quite useful is this little circuit, which there's probably not much point trying to draw down because I'll make all of this stuff available later. This is just to get your head around some of the concepts. So what we have is the output from the, see if we can get out of here without causing a screech. The output from the Arduino, which is switching a transistor, and there's a coil for a relay, so it's just turning on a relay whenever the output from the Arduino is switched. And I have one here. Actually, I have two here. Sorry? Okay. Yeah, sure. Shall we do that right now? Okay, we're just going to take a quick stop to change tapes. Yes, there's a comment here. I can't even remember. I did application search, PCB schematic, and found something.
It looks almost certain like
Eagle. Eagle? That sounds familiar. Yeah, sure, an announcement. Kim.
Because folks didn't pick up their other PCs this morning, they pulled another bunch of names out of the hat, and those names are up.
Lock the door.
So when we are finished for lunch, go out and check.
Yes, Marco. Yep. Okay. We should stick that up there later. Marco is just making a comment that there is a group for Linux Australia members in Second Life for getting together and building cool stuff. So we'll put some details of that up. Actually, maybe